is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, wow, it's amazing watching the Dow. That's down 174 points. I don't celebrate these things, but I am concerned about this, you know, where this is going. Anyhow, we've got that, and there's today is the 74th anniversary of Franklin Roosevelt's State of the Union address, in which he laid out his proposal for the four freedoms. And we will be talking with Professor Harvey Kay about that in the second hour. This is kind of the holy grail of liberalism, and this would be a very, very different country if FDR had had his way, good or bad. We'll talk about that in our second hour. Congress is meeting. John Boehner is going to get elected Speaker of the House any minute now. As much as I would love it to be Louis Gohmert, it ain't going to be. Oh, would I love it to be Louis Gohmert? I mean, for a bunch of good reasons. The comedy value being at the top of the list. And Mitch McConnell has, you know, basically come out and said that his first order of business over in the Senate is going to be reimbursing the Koch brothers for all the money they poured into Kentucky and you know, dark money, brilliant money, whatever, and all the ways that they've helped the Republican Party by making sure that the millions of acres of tar sands oil that they own up in Canada will be able to get to the refineries that they own down on the Gulf Coast so that it can be refined. You and I can get the poison, and they can export the gasoline and diesel fuel to China and make money on it. This seems crazy to me. Austin Peterson is on the line. He's the editor of The Libertarian Republic, thelibertarianrepublic.com. And Austin, maybe you can make some sense for me out of this. Why should we be excited about a Canadian company, TransCanada, shipping very, very toxic and you know, hard to refine oil all the way across the United States down to the Gulf Coast so that we can refine it and all the poisons from it stay right here in the United States and the refined products, the gasoline and diesel fuel and other high fractions and whatnot, are all exported? I mean, TransCanada on their website says this is how it's going to work. In fact, they predict that because taking the pipeline all the way down to the Gulf Coast will stop the refining process or reduce the amount of tar sands oil that's available to the refineries in the Midwest, that in the Midwestern United States, the price of gas will go up probably 15 cents a gallon as a result of the completion of the Keystone XL pipeline. I don't get it. Why would anybody support this unless they're a shill who's paid for by the Koch brothers?
Happy New Year, Tom, before you flame me alive.
Thank you.
Well, of course, I wish I was a shill for the Koch brothers. I wish the Koch brothers would pay me. Those are two of my big ideological heroes, mostly because of their liberal stances on the war on drugs and pro-gay marriage stances and things. But we can talk about their economics. And the reason why I would support the Keystone XL pipeline, even if prices perhaps went up 15 cents a gallon, is because it's actually safer than the current methods that we're using, where we're using trucks and railroads. Pipelines have actually spilled a lot less than trucks or railroads per ton of oil transported. So if we're going to have this sick, nasty, disgusting, evil poison that you call it, then it's better that we transport it by the pipeline than by transporting it by truck.
Wait a second here. So your logic is that even though there's no value to the United States in this whatsoever, we get none of this oil, and nobody's disputing that. Everybody's, you know, that's fairly transparent. There's no value to us at all. We are going to get poisoned by it. Mm-hmm. That the reason why we should do the pipeline is because right now we're being poisoned by rail cars, and we've got an aging rail infrastructure, and they're blowing up and leaking and things, and that's a horrible thing. So instead we should do a pipeline. Why don't we just say we're not going to be the third world dumping ground for the poisons of the fossil fuel industry in Canada? Let Canada build their own damn refineries and ship their own gasoline and diesel fuel to China.
Well, I mean, they're going
to
do that.
Why do we have to be the dumping ground, Austin?
Well, they're going to do that anyway. See, if we don't build the pipeline, they're going to ship that oil to China by diverting the pipeline across Canada.
Right.
And yeah, if
they've got a plan to do it. Why don't we just say, great, you guys go for it.
Yeah, but I disagree with your point that we're not going to see the benefit from any of the oil from that, because that's not yet been determined as to whether or not that oil will be diverted, all of it, to China. Yes, some of it will be, but that's still
TransCanada has been saying from the very beginning this is for export.
Yes, that is, they have been saying that, but there are a lot of American oil firms that are competing, that are bidding for this oil, so there is a chance that we could get some benefit from it.
Come
but
the on, biggest,
but if we did, Tom, wouldn't you like to see, and maybe you said years ago when we invaded Iraq that Bush did this for oil, no more blood for oil. You know, as an anti-war libertarian, Tom, I'm very concerned about our policy in the Middle East because the American military is being used to prop up regimes in the Middle East, dangerous regimes that are anti-liberal, anti-war.
Austin, do you know what the number one...
The military is enforcing that, Tom, and the reason why we have big government overseas kicking down people's doors, killing brown people, is because big corporations want to use our military to protect those oil pipelines overseas. Let's stop that. Nice try, Austin,
but do you know what the number one export from the United States was for the last 2 years in a row, the number one product that we exported?
Democracy.
No, it was gasoline. Gasoline and diesel fuel. Actually, it was diesel fuel mostly, and then gasoline was second. Mm-hmm. That's that, you know, our refineries in the Gulf Coast are running full tilt boogie continuously, and not just the Gulf Coast. There are West Coast and East Coast refineries all for export. All of this oil that's coming in from Canada is for export.
Well, that's okay too. I mean, we can make money by having the oil pump through our country, and we can have jobs as we export it. What's wrong with exporting?
Well, what's wrong with it is A, it's helping to destroy the planet. B, it's poisoning us. We get to keep the poisons. And C, if you want the United States to be energy independent, if you're concerned about Middle Eastern oil, then take the hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies that we're giving the oil industry and that we're proposing to give to TransCanada right now and put it into solar and wind.
It's so strange, the modern liberals today, they're such hardcore socialists and they're also such hardcore nationalists. So what do you call a national socialist in German?
That's
it makes you think. It makes you wonder.
No, it doesn't make me think at all. I'm trying to figure out how to say, Austin, that's the most nationalist. Stupid question I've ever heard.
Yeah, no, it's not. In fact, I was grasping for words to figure out a way to say
that's the most stupid question I've ever heard.
Oh, really? You don't like
the
that.
The Nazis were obviously nationalists, and they were not socialists.
Oh, yes, they were. They were hardcore socialists. They believed in the collective over the individual. They believed in the state, the government as supreme, just like yourself. You are an economic nationalist. You're an economic socialist.
Somehow you are attempting to convert a conversation about the Keystone Pipeline into a revisiting of the history of Nazi Germany. It's not going to work, Austin. Sorry. The Nazis are gone. They're dead. At least the old ones.
Do you not ascribe to the same belief in the state, the government, over the individual?
Austin, are you not suggesting that is not Austin?
You're terrified. Sig Heil, Tom. Yeah, you know that's what this leads to. Economic.
What you are suggesting here, Austin, is that we should let TransCanada, we should let a corporation, and the Koch brothers with their oil up there and their refineries down here, and all these other things. We should let them be deciding policy for the United States rather than we, the people, deciding policy. Now, if you want to call me a nationalist or even a Nazi for saying that I believe that my nation should be making decisions in the best interest of my nation, then fine, call me whatever you want. But I am on the record here as and I think that your internationalist view that we should have no boundaries, this whole libertarian thing of, you know, absolute free trade, no boundaries, anybody can move anywhere, is crazy. It has never worked anywhere.
Wow. Well, at least you admit it, Tom. A hardcore nationalist, a hardcore socialist. I mean, it doesn't really get more Nazi than that, buddy. I mean, the fact
the Nazis
is
were a death cult, Austin. Stop for a second. You are trashing the memory of the people who were killed by the Nazis. The Nazis were a death cult. They had nothing to do
with it. I got you good today.
All right. Austin Peterson, thelibertarianrepublic.com. Thanks, Austin. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, am I a Nazi? Really? What do you think? We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man. What can you say? Somebody says, you're a Nazi. Why do you reply? Really? It's like somebody saying, I think you're actually a frog. Somebody kissed you, you turned into a human, but you're actually a frog. Maybe, I don't know. It's amazing. Anyhow, and this John Barrasso, we don't have a clip of this, do we? Of John Barrasso lying on the floor of the Senate a couple days ago? Yeah, this was it was on Meet the Press, right? He told Chuck Todd that the Keystone XL pipeline will create 42,000 jobs. And did Chuck Todd say, hey, wait a minute, you're lying? No, of course he didn't, because he wants John Barrasso to come back on his program again in the future so he can lie again. Tell me I'm not going crazy on this. According to the State Department, this pipeline will create 35 full-time jobs. I'm amazed that Austin didn't try to pull the jobs trick out of his hat. You got the Barrasso clip? Oh, here he is, right here.
What's the first bill that's coming on the president's desk from this Republican Congress?
The president's going to see the Keystone XL pipeline on his desk, and it is going to be a bellwether decision by the president whether to go with jobs in the economy. His own State Department said it's 42,000 new jobs. This is a good infrastructure project supported widely across the United States. He's going to have to decide between jobs and the extreme supporters of not having the pipeline.
Senator Klobuchar, where are you on this? What's the first bill that's coming on the
Yeah, right. As opposed to, so you just move along and ask another question. Don't say, what? Did you just say 42,000 jobs? When, anyway. End of rant, I suppose. Tim, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Rockvale, Tennessee. Hey, Tim, you wanted to talk about the vet suicide bill?
Yes, sir. The one that Mr. Coburn so cowardly put a hold on before he left.
Right.
His last act of cowardice.
Yeah, that was, in fact, it was a bill that almost certainly would have passed with bipartisan support.
Well, I've been calling my senators, and I hope everybody else will call theirs to maybe reintroduce that bill.
Yeah.
Because my wife's nephew, Iraq veteran, just turned 30 years old, three daughters, and a wife committed suicide this morning.
Oh, man.
And,
I'm so sorry.
Only one. There's many others. So
I think it's 11 a day, isn't it? That vets who are committing suicide. I mean, it's some extraordinary number. It's one every other hour or thereabouts.
And I know Tom Coburn used to be on your show all the time.
No, Tom Coburn has never been on our show.
There's somebody else that's been on your show.
Yeah, there's a bunch of right wing, a bunch of members of conservative and Republican members of the House of Representatives. Steve King actually used to be on our show a lot.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
Anyways, I just hope everybody will call their senator. I don't know the name of the bill or the number, but
it's going to have to be reintroduced with a whole brand new number. So and there is no bill right now, so there is no number. So what you would say if you call the congressional switchboard line, which is 202-225-3121, to say, let's make up for the damage that Tom Coburn did to our veterans on his way out of town. You just say, please reintroduce that bill to fund a program to help veterans who are considering suicide. Tim, I'm sorry to hear about the tragedy in your family. Thank you for calling and sharing the story with us. We'll be right. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I just want to welcome back 20 minutes past the hour. I just wanted to kind of for the record or just assert this. There was, toward the end of that conversation, when I said to Austin that by trying to turn this debate about Keystone XL, trying to use this as a pivot to somehow suggest that I'm a Nazi or I'm supporting Nazi policies or whatever, that he was disrespecting the people who the Nazis killed. And it wasn't just the Jews. It was the Jews. It was the trade unionists. It was the communists. It was gays. It was, people who were nationalists, who were fighting against the Nazis from Norway to France that were trashing their memory. And he sort of laughed about it, like, got you. I don't consider these debates entertainment. And I am inclined to not want to debate people who react as if it was just theater And which is why very rarely do you see such people or hear such people on this program. Rather, I think that debating issues with people who actually have an argument to make or a position that they believe in is a good thing for all of us. It's a good thing in as much as it gives me an opportunity to say, hey, here's a way to debate this. Here are the facts from my point of view. Here is the world from my point of view. Gives them an opportunity to say that. It gives you an opportunity to say, okay, now I know both sides of the argument. I can make up my own mind. You know, those are good things that come out of these kinds of debates. And I'm still scratching my head. I'm still trying to, it seems, and again, Austin isn't here to defend himself, so I'm not personalizing this to him. Let me generalize it, in fact. There is no value to the United States in the Keystone XL pipeline. There is no value to us in it. There's considerable danger to us in it. This pipeline is crossing water aquifers, particularly the Ogallala Aquifer, that are precious natural resources that once polluted can take 5, 10, 15,000 years to recover. It is a 1,100 or 1,200 mile long terrorist bullseye, or even crazy person bullseye. It is taking poison from Canada. You know, tar sands oil are poisonous. Extracting the valuable stuff from the poison, the gasoline, the diesel fuel, and selling that overseas and leaving the poison here in the United States for us to deal with. The best argument that Austin had for us is, hey, these companies are going to do it anyway. And I'm saying, why don't we stop them? Why don't we say no? I mean, we have a law on the books right now that says that you can't export crude oil from the United States. That goes back to, as I recall, the 70s. Why don't we just say you can't import tar sands oil into the United States anymore? We don't need it. And then let's take those subsidies and trust me, they're there, even when they're not explicit, even when it's not cash dollars. There are subsidies in as much as we are using the Fifth Amendment to take land away from people to give to a Canadian corporation all across the United States through eminent domain. That's a form of subsidy. We're going to have to provide security for this thing. Every police department, every fire department through which, you know, in the communities through which this pipeline runs, which is literally the breadth of the country, it's going right down the middle of our country, are going to have to provide security for it. There's so many reasons why we shouldn't be doing this. Not to mention the fact that the largest carbon store on Earth right now is the tar sands up in Canada. And as James Hansen said, if we tap that in a big way, it's game over for planet Earth. Hey, we live on planet Earth. It is like frighteningly, bitterly cold right now in Washington, D.C., and it's going to get a lot worse. It's not actually frighteningly. It's in the high 20s, low 30s. But it's going to get down into the teens in a couple of days. And we're on the Mason-Dixon line. I mean, we're sort of on the edge of it in the south. What's happened? Well, what's happened is that this incredibly cold air from the Arctic regions is starting to drool way down south in the United States. Now, it's done this occasionally for decades, centuries, in all probability. But right now, it seems to be happening every year. I mean, this is the new normal. The jet stream has gotten clogged up by virtue of global warming because we're raising the temperature of the Arctic so much. Do we really want to add to that? So because there is no good argument to be made for the Keystone XL pipeline, and they always just figured they'd slip this by without us having a national debate about it, they've got to come up with lies. You get this Republican Senator Barrasso coming on Meet the Press lying to Chuck Todd. Of course, Chuck Todd doesn't call him out on it because, as Chuck Todd told us all 2 weeks ago, he never contradicts his guests, because even when he knows that they're lying, because then they won't come on the show anymore. And he would lose his job over that. Or at least he thinks he would. I mean, somebody should show him Hard Talk, this show in the BBC has where, the host takes on, literally the prime minister, and just takes them apart. But so either you've got to lie about it, or you've got to say, hey, it's going to happen anyway. You might as well do it this way as another way. No, it doesn't have to happen anyway. I mean, there is no argument for the Keystone XL pipeline. I am very hopeful that the president vetoes this thing. This is just a big wet kiss to the Koch brothers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And the rest of the very dirty part of the fossil fuel industry that's involved with Canadian tar sands. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Atropaically ugly, the good. Governor Martin O'Malley, the outgoing Maryland governor and potential 2016 presidential candidate, is showing conservatives what it really means to be pro-life. He's announced that as one of his last official acts as governor, he will commute the sentences of Maryland's four remaining death row inmates. While the old line state abolished capital punishment in 2013, those four inmates were still retroactively eligible for the death penalty. Now they're going to get life without parole. The death penalty is still a controversial issue that many politicians would rather steer away from than try to address head on. Good on Martin O'Malley for having the courage to fight for what's right, even if it might hurt his presidential prospects. The bad, Pat Robertson. On Monday's episode of the 700 Club, the conservative televangelist recommended that a viewer beat, yes, beat, as in beat up, a young relative who smokes pot and criticizes Christianity. Seriously, check it out.
Somebody take that kid to the woodshed and let him understand the blessings of discipline. He needs a strong male figure. I don't know about his daddy, where the daddy is. But
well, the daughter is the child of this couple.
The kid's got a father someplace, and the father may be out of town, and the mother's not disciplined.
Beating a troubled kid. How very Christian of you, Pat. And the very, very ugly, the Ku Klux Klan. What a surprise, right? America's worst homegrown terrorist group is under fire this week for a billboard it put up in northern Arkansas to try to get people to listen to its radio station. The billboard, which is located in the town of Harrison, shows a young white girl holding a puppy next to the phrase, "It's not racist to hurt your people." Also includes the website for White Pride Radio. The fact that the KKK is still alive and active in this country is bad enough, but the fact that it's trying to pass off its racist hate as puppy love, that is very, very ugly. By the way, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here in just a second. Are you watching this controversy about Chris Christie? He went down and he watched, the game between Texas and Detroit, I think it was, the Detroit Lions, with the Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones in his luxury suite. Turns out that he was flown down there, Jerry Jones' private jet. But there's questions are being raised about, Jerry Jones actually has a business relationship with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. And he gave what appears to be about a $30,000 gift to Chris Christie and inviting him to the luxury suite, flying him down on a private jet. And nobody, the Christie campaign, the Christie folks are refusing to talk about how much it costs to move Chris Christie's security detail with him. It's this, there was that embarrassing photo of him hugging the guy where he just kind of looks, optically, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look presidential, shall we say. Anyhow, some interesting tweets. Jay Cochran, I prefer that you didn't interview immature juveniles. No, come on. The producer, it can be very disturbing when you realize that you are a national socialist. Of course, I'm a liberal. Classical. It's great. Your guest comments, this guitar sun cat says, your guest's comments regarding nationalism and the American left simply divorced from reality, demonstrated occluded thinking. Very interesting. GBR Shallow, Tom Hartman, not when calling out a Nazi sympathizer. I'm going to have to read that conversation. Anyhow, I know a lot of people wanted to get in on this conversation. So Keith in St. Francis, South Dakota. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Keith.
I'm with the Spirit Camp of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. We're pretty much right in the way of the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
We're meeting today with our PUC to try and find out a way to bypass us. But our camp is set up with the thought of changing things by returning to when we were born with a clear mind and a good heart. And we're trying to return to that through prayer at our camp. And thus far, it's been working and delaying the pipeline. And we try to pray every day for good things for all people. Matter of fact, we're with the Cowboy Indian Alliance in Nebraska. We have the cowboy group down there, Bold Nebraska, which are kind of our partners in stopping this pipeline. And one thing that I would like to say about the Ogallala aquifers, it irrigates our food products clear down to Texas.
Right.
And if this pipeline pollutes that water, we won't have any food. Anything that's worth eating. And it surprises me that our politicians, just because of the Canadian border, don't look at the horrible things that's done to that country up there.
Yeah.
The Native Americans up there, high cancer rates. It's polluted all their water resources up there. The people are in bad shape.
Yeah.
They are affiliated with our camp down here.
Yeah, I'm with you, Keith. Just the whole tar sands thing has devastated large chunks of Alberta, and particularly the native lands and the native peoples around there. It's good on you for praying for this every day, and thanks so much for the call. Thanks for giving us the heads up on that from the South Dakota point of view. Steve in Long Island, New York. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Back at you.
Austin seems to be confusing nationalism and fascism. I've noticed this on the right. They really don't know what everything is with the last ending of an ism. They just merge them all together and say, that's what it is.
It seems.
Because what he was describing was fascism. That's not what you're saying. You're saying if the oil comes through here, you got to give us something. We're doing something for you. You got to do something for us. And that's what all these amendments to this Keystone Pipeline bill are going to say that the Democrats are going to put in. And they have the gall to say if Obama vetoes this, he's anti-job, anti-economy. My God, have they had their head in the ground for the last 50
months? No, Steve,
months?
The people who are saying this know exactly what's going on, and they are lying to the American people. They are aggressively lying to the American people because there's billions of dollars. There's hundreds of billions of dollars to be made here. There's profit that's unimaginable. So you know, giving a politician a couple million bucks or giving, you know, a few million dollars to a couple of think tanks so that they can, you know,
it's the cost of doing business.
Yeah, it's not even a fraction of the cost of doing business. It's public relations is always more effective than advertising, and they're basically buying PR, and they have been for a couple of years now. But they're just lying to the American people. Excellent points, though, on the isms and the, you know, and it's not just conservatives. This is so many Americans don't understand the origins of so many of these words. It just makes me crazy. But that's a whole other topic and another rant for another time. Steve, thank you for the call. Excellent points. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Happy New Year, Tom.
Happy New Year to you, too, Paul.
Before you say let's not attack Austin Peters when he's not here to defend himself, I just want to say he just was here. he was offensive. So
okay.
I don't think it's shooting him in the back to say that when he ran out of weak points that we've heard all of them before. And then he comes up with a wholly stupid analogy that momentarily leaves Tom Hartman speechless, and then he says, ah, ha, 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 gotcha, gotcha, gotcha. And then he had to keep up the mocking laughter because he knew the segment was irretrievable after that. After doing that. How do you put on a straight face and continue the debate? That's exiting stage left right there. So I don't need to hear from that guy anymore.
Okay.
I really, at least let him know that if he's going to come on the show, let's stick to the topic. But yeah. To address some of his points, when he acknowledged that, well, probably the United States will get nothing out of it, well, I wondered if he realizes that since the Keystone project, the American project, has been delayed, TransCanada has thought about going, taking it east or west in Canada. And the provinces in Canada, both east and west of Alberta, have brought it to court to say that, no, we don't want it coming across here either way, east or west either.
Right.
So I guess since Canada is somewhat of a socialist country, in their national interest, not wanting tar sands oil spilled all over, that makes Canada a Nazi country.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
Who knew? We've got Nazis on our northern border. National
exactly.
socialists. Holy cow.
Yeah. There's
actually, it's nationalists.
And they have national socialists. Interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I mean, just like any country that's socialist and has national interests would by definition, in Austin Peters' dictionary, be Nazis.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, the last point I want to make here is that we've been hearing already that, oh, Obama's going to stiff-arm the Congress, and if he vetoes this, well, he's just not he's not in step with the American people. I just checked this out today. Barack Obama has... the fewest vetoes since John Adams.
Wow. Seriously?
Two vetoes. Let's compare it to Ronald Reagan, who had a Democratic Congress. 78.
At this point in his presidency.
Yeah, during his two terms in president.
Oh, his entire 8 years, he had 78 vetoes. Well, Obama may hit 78 by the end of the next 2 years here. We'll see, Paul.
We can only hope.
I agree. Thanks a lot for the call. It's always great hearing from you, Paul. Thank you very much. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We will be right back here on the Tom Hartman program. A lot of people want to get in on this conversation, and it's an interesting one. It's a very interesting one. And then up next in the next hour, the Four Freedoms. How it would have changed America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And believe me, if FDR had not died when he did, and if he had followed through on the Four Freedoms, this would be a very different country right now, for the better. Welcome back. Jeez, it looks like John Barrasso has the same glasses as I do. That's not good. Yeah, welcome back. Let's see. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, this will take about 20 seconds. Since Austin just called you a Nazi, at least the Nazis only used their military to do the attempted genocide. When America proceeded with its attempted genocide of Native Americans, we used our military and our citizenry, a.k.a. our previous scalping conversation.
Yeah.
So when you think about it, who was worse, the Nazis or our early American forefathers? Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Michael. I would say that's a comparison that should not be made. Both were terrible. Both were genocides. I think one of the biggest problems that we have in the United States right now is that we don't teach in our schools that our nation was founded on genocide and slavery. We don't teach the real political, sociological, and economic history of this country. And it's not self-flagellation. I'm not suggesting that we should be having those conversations in our schools as a way of beating ourselves up or something. It's that you can't move forward unless you understand where you came from. It's like the way that you know, it's called dead reckoning. The way that you walk through the woods. I used to live in the forest up in Vermont. And, you know, the way you walk straight through the woods is you figure out which direction you want to go, first of all, and then you sight something that's near you, and then you sight something that's about as far away as you can see that are in a direct line with each other. And you walk to the thing that, just before you get to the thing that's as far away as you can see, and then you look back at the thing where you came from, and then you look forward, you create another line going forward, and you find the object that's the most distant from that. In other words, it's, like I said, it's called dead reckoning. It's just, you know, it's navigation by sight. But you have to know where you came from in order to know where you're going. And this is a country that was founded in blood. I mean, in a massive way. The genocide of Native Americans in this country is one of the great, and I don't mean great as in good, I mean as in massive, historical genocides in the history of the modern world. Starting, you know, arguably in 1607, Jamestown was founded. Right up to today. John McCain just stole the Apache Tears land from the Apaches and gave it to Rio Tinto, an Australian mining company, by slipping this amendment into that the Cromnibus Bill. John friggin' McCain stole land, thousands of some of the most sacred land that the Apache have in Arizona, where a group of Apaches, when they were confronted by genocidal American soldiers, committed mass suicide. Which is why it's called Apache Tears. It's the Apache Masada. And we just gave it away to a mining company from Australia? Really? I mean, it's not like it was just some distant part of our past. And I don't think that the American people would have tolerated that if they knew the history of this country. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve, you wanted to talk about National Socialists?
Yeah, Tom. Hey, I love your show.
Thank you.
And I always enjoy it. But I know you're kind of a World War II historian, and so am I. And I don't know. That guy was wrong. It is true that the Nazis were called the National Socialists, and that's why for Nazi. But they appropriated that name when they were running for office to get into power. That was right after World War II, and there was the country was
World War
One. Apart.
Right, it was
World War One, exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry, and the country was falling apart, and it was chaos. And there was like 15 or 20 parties, and socialism was very popular, but there was a lot of confusion going on. And the Nazis deliberately called themselves socialists just because it was popular. So it
you're
was
absolutely
a deliberate
right.
lie.
Yeah,
but they were fascists.
Yeah. No, you're right, and they were fairly openly fascist too. Except that ultimately the Nazis weren't even fascists, because I mean the first couple of years, fascism being the merger of government and business interests, you know, Hitler was using the big industrialists, playing them like a fiddle. But ultimately, Nazism became a death cult.
I guess you're probably right about that. I suppose that's true. It did become more of a death cult after a while. That's true. But I believe that, you know, war was their product that they were doing. That was their product that they were making. So,
yeah.
You know, it was very fascist, I think.
No, the cult nature of the Nazis is fascinating. You get into the SS and Wavelsberg,
oh God,
and what was going on there, and it's amazing stuff. But there's no modern analogy other than maybe some of the really hard right here in the United States who have all these weird theories about Obama being a secret communist and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's about as close as you can get to it. But they're not you know, as anywhere near as toxic as the real Nazis were.
And that's something else that just drives me crazy. They always mix the words communism and socialism, and there's a big difference.
Yeah.
Communism was kind of, you know, it was an extreme tyranny. Socialism is what you got all over Europe, and you got it here in the U.S., and it's as American as apple pie.
Yeah, it's Social Security as a form of socialism. And communism has never, on a national level, has never been done the way that Karl Marx proposed it. Instead, it's been used as an excuse for essentially, you know, one-party rule. So, Steve, excellent points. Thank you for the call. James in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James.
Good afternoon, Mr. Revere. How are you? And happy New Year.
Thank you. Back at you, James.
Yeah, I just want to address a few things. First off, Mr. Peterson, I recognize quite a few people in the area I live in and seem to be disturbed people in our midst. Kind of concerns me. But
okay.
Trying to address the tar sands, there's something that could simply be done with these tankers, and this addresses something from World War II. Our aircraft were actually designed with self-sealing fuel tanks, and these bladders could actually be put inside these tanks to make them very safe for transportation, and that would eliminate the use of the XL pipeline with just that done in itself.
Well, and this, again, is one of the regulations that many on the right are, quote, objecting to. They're doing away with these old, what were they called, 110 train cars, the unlined train cars that you know, easily puncture and break, and they're replacing them with double-hulled or lined or bladder-filled. I don't know if they have a bladder or not, but, you know, the less likely to spill. And it's getting more expensive, and the oil industry is not happy about that. So, but excellent point, James. Excellent. Thank you for the call. Carl in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carl.
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
Great to talk to you. I love your show. I've been listening to you for years, and I think this is the first time I've actually had a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to address what Peters was talking about.
Peterson. Austin Peterson.
I collect a lot of quotes. And there is a site called thinkexist.com, which has the quotes from Adolf Hitler and Hermann Göring. And Hermann Göring made this statement: our movement took a grip on cowardly Marxism, and from it extracted the meaning of socialism. It also took from the cowardly middle class parties their nationalism. Throwing both in the cauldron of our way of life, there emerged, as clear as crystal, the synthesis, German National Socialism.
Wow. That's from Göring.
That is a great site. And also, he said, education is dangerous. Every educated person is a future enemy.
Yeah. Well, I was, like Pol Pot. I mean, he started out his genocidal rampage by killing anybody who had glasses, which meant that they were literate.
Yeah, and then my other favorite quote is from, Mussolini, who described fascism as corporatism. And as I've gotten from your show long ago, you've often talked about fascism and the link to corporatism. So basically, Mr. Peters is really the fascist.
Yeah, arguably. Peterson, actually. S-O-N or S-E-N. I'm not sure how he spells it. I think it's S-O-N.
Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for all that you do for America, for our people, and just wish you the happiest of New Year's.
Well, thank you, Carl. Thanks for listening, and the very, very best back at you. Thanks very much for the call. And we'll be back. We're going to talk with Professor Harvey Kay, old friend of the show, professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, about how America would be different today if Franklin Roosevelt had actually gotten the four freedoms passed that he was fighting for when he died. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is remarkable. This Franklin Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address this to the 77th Congress on this day back in 19, whatever the year was, and let me get Harvey on and just tell us all about this. Professor Harvey Kay is with us, professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay. He's the author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And his Twitter feed is slash Harvey J. Kay, K-A-Y-E. Hey, Harvey.
Tom, it is great to hear your voice, and it is so cold here in Wisconsin this week that just to know I was coming on, I warmed up.
That's sweet. That's sweet. It's frighteningly cold here for D.C. So, Professor, here I'm reading the speech that that FDR gave, and he says, a free nation has the right to expect full cooperation from all groups. A free nation has the right to look to the leaders of business, of labor, and of agriculture to take the lead in stimulating effort, not among other groups, but within their own group. The best way of dealing with a few slackers or troublemakers in our midst is first to shame them by patriotic example, and if that fails, to use the sovereignty of government to save government. Save government?
Save government. You know, I was really worried about the possibility that there were, you know, corporations that were still cooperating with Nazi Germany in 1941. And he was seriously concerned that they might actually undermine the war effort in favor of their own profits. So when he gave that address on January 6, 1941, basically he was speaking to the American people to mobilize them for defense, and he knew over the horizon the war that was already waging in East Asia and in Europe. And he was concerned, seriously concerned, that he might not secure the cooperation of big business that he knew was essential basically to mobilize the, you know, arsenal of democracy and then to win the war.
Right. His four freedoms, the four freedoms get all the attention, you know, the freedom of speech, freedom of to worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And I want to get into that. But I think that earlier on in the speech, he said the basic things expected by our people of their political and economic systems are simple. They are equality of opportunity for youth and for others, jobs for those who can work, security for those who need it, the end of special privilege for the few, and the preservation of civil liberties for all.
Yeah, isn't that, I mean, there's a great speech. You know, it isn't just those four freedoms, which are wonderful and so inspiring. It's also that when he was talking to the American people, he knew that many were concerned that, in fact, the New Deal might be in jeopardy. And conservative members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, overwhelmingly Republican in those terms, they were saying, well, okay, well, we're going to prepare for defense and we're going to prepare for war. So therefore, we should end all of the New Deal initiatives. Basically, we need to suspend what we've been doing and possibly even just, you know, destroy them, you know, to bring them to an end. And Roosevelt said, wait a second. He said, if you're going to mobilize for defense and for war, it doesn't mean you suspend the victories of these last several years. You actually do more than that. You don't just even sustain them. You advance them. I mean, he understood what a democracy was about. And he knew that if you're going to go to war, you've got to have healthy, confident, educated people. People who feel their rights, who feel that they are defending not a country owned by the 1%, but a country which is theirs in the most fundamental sense of freedom, equality, and democracy. And that's what that speech was about, really. It wasn't just, I mean, it was fundamentally, you know, a call to war, in some ways, I think, more important than the Pearl Harbor speech. Mm-hmm. But it was also this sort of declaration that we're going to continue to sustain our values. Now, he made terrible mistakes in the weeks that came that followed, the internment of the Japanese Americans and other things. But the fact is that on the grandest scale, he did try to encourage Americans to see that this war was going to really be about those four freedoms.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but at various points in his presidency, did not Franklin Roosevelt basically say that it is the responsibility of government to be the employer of last resort, essentially that there should not be unemployment in the United States of America?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, over and over again, the idea of the New Deal was not simply to you know, get us out of an economic depression by way of a recovery. It was also to carry out major projects of, first of all, relief, but then beyond that, reconstruction and reform. And, you know, if there hadn't been a depression, but for some reason Roosevelt had been elected, you know, it's difficult to imagine, you know, things that alternative. But it's still likely that Roosevelt would have pursued many of the projects he pursued in the face of the Depression. I mean, he believed in the Civilian Conservation Corps. He believed in modernization. He believed in engaging Americans in the labors and struggles that were required for Americans to advance themselves and their nation at the same time. But so indeed, I think that what Roosevelt saw in his 8 years in the New Deal is the degree to which not only he had these ideas as a progressive, liberal, democratic politician, but also that Americans themselves had these kinds of hopes and aspirations and wanted to apply their energy to them, which is also, again, to go back to the speech, why when he says, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want and freedom from fear, he doesn't think he's talking to people about something they don't know anything about. He truly believes that these are the fundamental ideals of American life.
Right. So if we had a nation and had had a nation for the, I mean, basically this all got suspended after the war and, you know, the, mm-hmm. In larger part, I suppose, with the election of Eisenhower in 52, if we had a nation where you were guaranteed a job, where the government was the employer of last resort, there was always zero unemployment, nobody ever had to fear unemployment, and the wages were such that, you know, the kind of Teddy Roosevelt square deal definition, you know, that that you could raise
the
your
American
family.
Standard of living. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You could raise your family. You could put your kids through school. You had enough to pay for health insurance. You had enough to set aside a reasonable retirement for old age. Your direct quote from Teddy Roosevelt. How different would America be today just with that one thing? I mean, he also talked about, you know, making sure that everybody had free education, free health care and housing if they needed it.
Yeah,
but let's just look at jobs. I mean, how different would this country be if we all agreed that the government should be the employer of last resort?
Every one of us who just heard your question is probably doing what I'm doing here. I'm nodding in agreement. And that kind of America would be a healthier America, a better fed America. I mean, this would be the America that Americans have always wanted. Not to go on at length, but, you know, a few years later in January of 1944, Roosevelt followed up the Four Freedoms speech with his Economic Bill of Rights speech and lays out all the very things that you're talking about as a project for post-war America.
Right. And do you know of any country that has done that?
On that scale, well, the Europeans themselves, I think, were really inspired by Roosevelt's Four Freedoms and the Second Bill of Rights. And I think if you look at what happened in Europe after the war, you'd see the development of many of those things. I think probably the great shock is that it's America, you know, leading the way intellectually and culturally and politically, and then failing to actually pursue the very things that Roosevelt and Americans themselves wanted. In 1943 and 1944, surveys showed that 85% of Americans wanted a full, all-out social democratic America in the post-war years.
Wow.
But of course, the Republicans and conservatives, you know, rallied against it. And Roosevelt himself passed away on April 12th, 1945. By the way, we're coming up to the 70th anniversary of that this spring. So, you know, if he had lived, you know, that's a whole other discussion we can have.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if just his idea had lived.
Well, you know, Truman, when he came into office on Roosevelt's death, he spoke of doing just that. But he really wasn't up to the task. He didn't have the kind of political skills and talents that Roosevelt did.
Right.
And he basically backed off because, by the way, no president can pursue any initiative without the backing of the American people, organized Americans.
I'm with you. Professor Harvey K., hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can tweet Harvey at Harvey J. K., K-A-Y-E. And he's the author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, among other brilliant books. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you, Tom.
We should play some clips from this speech. I didn't want to, you know, you got Harvey K. on the line. You don't want to play clips. You want to hear what Harvey has to say, but Here's how Franklin Roosevelt, we'll just go through these in order, if that's okay with you, Shana. Here's how he started this thing in the future days. Here he is.
In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms.
And then he says the first of these freedoms.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world.
And notice the everywhere in the world. This is the kind of bringing it together. We're fighting a great war against an oppressive force, you know, the Nazis and all this kind of thing. So these are our values as a nation. Freedom of expression and speech everywhere in the world, number one. Second.
The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world.
And I would like to think that if FDR was still around, he would, in the modern day, add to that, or to choose not to worship any god, or to worship multiple gods. It is simply, you know, the very much like, you know, Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which essentially repudiated Christianity as a national religion. In fact, Jefferson wrote in his diaries about how when he wrote that, some of the people who were collaborating with him said, you know, the holy author of our nation, Jesus Christ, and he got the words Jesus Christ deleted from the text, from the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, on which the First Amendment was based. Anyhow, back to Franklin Roosevelt. The third freedom, and this is where, hey, if you don't have a job, the government's job is to give you a job, provide a job. Third is freedom.
The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understanding, which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world.
That's the third freedom, and that's, you know, basically freedom from fear of economic disaster. And the fourth freedom, the freedom from fear. Here's Franklin Roosevelt on the fourth freedom.
The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
Wow. And then he goes on to say, you know, this is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. This kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny, which the dictators seek to create with the crash of a bomb. That the new order we oppose, to that new order we oppose, the greater conception, the moral order. A good society is able to face schemes of world domination and foreign revolutions alike without fear. Now contrast that to the fear and terror and trembling of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. It's amazing. We'll be back 20 minutes past that. CIA flipped out behind the scenes when Bush said U.S. would ban torture. Do you know which website this came from? Huffington Post. Okay, because it says data text. It's like, how can you? Anyway, it's George W. Bush, June 26th, 2003. It was the UN International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. And George W. Bush gave a speech. It was not a speech. Oh, it was a comment in a press conference? Uh-huh. Okay, well, here's what George W. Bush had to say.
If there is somebody captured, and it looks like there may be, I expect those people to be treated humanely. I expect them to be treated, the POWs, I expect to be treated humanely. And just like we're treating the prisoners that we have captured humanely. If not, the people who mistreat the prisoners will be treated as war criminals.
Right. He was saying this as he was completing the 186th, I think, waterboarding of KSM, of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. What he said on the International Day of in support of victims of torture, he said, "Torture anywhere is an affront to human dignity everywhere. The United States is committed to the worldwide elimination of torture, and we are leading this fight by example. I call on all governments to join with the United States and the community of law-abiding nations in prohibiting, investigating, and prosecuting all acts of torture." This is George W. Bush saying this while he knew that he was torturing people. Now, the reason I flip to that moment is that it's the exact antithesis, the exact opposite of what Franklin Roosevelt was working for when we were fighting with the Nazis. I mean, before then and through that time, he said, you know, we want to have a world founded on four essential freedoms. He said the first is the freedom of speech and expression. This is a speech he gave, you know, 74 years ago today. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, anywhere, everywhere in the world. The third is a freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear. And here's where it gets really interesting. Freedom from fear. I mean, keep in mind, this is the guy who's leading the free world in a world war against the fascists in Germany and in Japan. And listen to this. This is clip number five, Shane. Listen to what he says freedom from fear means.
The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
He was calling for universal disarmament. The end of war. I mean, it's truly astonishing. And then he went on to say, and this is clip number six. He went on to say, these are not just happy words. Here he is.
That is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. That kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny which the dictators seek to create with the crash of a bomb.
It's absolutely brilliant. This clip number eight, this is the speech that Franklin Roosevelt gave 74 years ago today. He talks, since the beginning of our American history, we've been engaged in change, in a perpetual peaceful revolution. This is what Jefferson was, you know, over and over and over again said his vision of America is we would constantly be in a state of change, of revolution. In fact, Jefferson suggested every 19 years we should reexamine the Constitution. Here's FDR on that.
Since the beginning of our American history, we have been engaged in change, in a perpetual, peaceful revolution, a revolution which goes on steadily, quietly, adjusting itself to changing conditions, without the concentration camp or the quicklime in the ditch. The world order which we seek is the cooperation of free countries working together in a friendly, civilized society.
Now, contrast that with George W. Bush cutting deals with nations that were desperate to get our money and our approval, like Poland, for example, that was just, you know, absolutely in a disaster in the early 2000s economically. I mean, they're basically a developing country as a consequence of having been a Soviet satellite all those years, where he went to them and said, if you will take these prisoners from Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly Iraq, if you will take these prisoners and torture them for us and tell us what they have to say, we will give you goodies. And then on the other side of his mouth, George W. Bush is saying we should prosecute people who commit torture. Play that clip again of Bush. We've got time.
If there is somebody captured, and it looks like there may be, I expect those people to be treated humanely. I expect them to be treated, the POWs, I expect to be treated humanely. And just like we're treating the prisoners that we have captured humanely. If not, the people who mistreat the prisoners will be treated as war criminals.
Right. War criminals, people who shackle prisoners to naked to a cold floor until they die. People who electroshock them, people who crush the testicles of their children in front of them. Yes, we did those things. People who threaten to rape their wives and daughters in front of them. People who lead them around, you know, it's just, it's amazing. It's starting to sound like torture porn. I'm going to stop there. Such a contrast from FDR to
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The Bush presidency was not only not the FDR presidency, it was the opposite of the FDR presidency. This falls into the category of don't call up Pat Robertson and tell him he might have a coronary. There's the S&P 400, the S&P 500, the S&P 600, three different Standard & Poor's indexes on the stock market. Right now, looking at the New York Times business page, the S&P 600 is at 666.69. 666. Interesting. What does that mean? I don't know. Anyhow. Paula in Folsom, California. Hey, Paula, you wanted to talk about Keystone XL?
Yes, I just wanted to let you know that it's very interesting. In 1976, I was a mine safety officer for a coal mine in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And we went to Denver and were having dinner with a coal broker, coal and oil. And she would scout for the government, among other people. And she had told us just when, you know, at that time they discovered this huge coal shale area in Canada, northern Alberta, mm-hmm. which is where they... And she said... that was a huge area, and it was a pity because Canada would never allow them to get to that filthy coal. It was so bad. They couldn't use it for coal. They couldn't use it for oil because it was just too dirty to work with, and it would never be used.
Right.
And so instead of that, the Koch brothers bought it.
Yeah.
And the Canadian government, they said, would never ever let it be used, and we would never let it be used in our oil supply or coal supply.
Well, that was back when oil was what, $20 a barrel?
Right. Oh, yeah, less.
So, I think that if anything stops this, now the president has, the White House has apparently issued a statement saying that the president will veto or will not sign anyway a Keystone XL bill. I think that, you know, what might stop Keystone XL, and this might be what the Saudis had in mind, is $50 a barrel oil, because it probably mm-hmm. costs $80, $90 a barrel to extract that stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we had trouble even shipping over some of the aquifers in Colorado, which are not great, but as huge as the Ogallala. But the Ogallala Aquifer, to put it anywhere near that area, and the amount of leakage just in the Yellowstone River, it's unbelievable what happens to the earth.
Yeah, it's insane what they're planning to do.
We're killing ourselves from within.
Yep. Also, that a bunch of billionaires can become multi-billionaires, and multi-billionaires can become multi-billionaires. Paula, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Excellent, fascinating story. Mark in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year, and thank you for being an inspiration. I think you're a very knowledgeable person, and every day you help to educate me and everybody, and Thanks for Free Speech TV, too.
Thank you, Mark.
It really saves me in desperate times and keeps me going. Hey, Tom, I just want to bring up a kind of connection of capitalism and corporations, like their war on the planet, and it might be related to the Keystone Pipeline, because if the oil if the pipeline goes through, where's the oil going to go? And if it goes to China, how's it going to get there? Well, in Nicaragua, they just okayed and started building this new super canal that's going to go through Lake Nicaragua. And through, they have an amazing bioreserve there, and they're preserving the indigenous people, even have a lot of land to live on in a natural way. And these canals are going to go right through a lot of reserves.
Right. And you know who's funding that canal?
It's a Chinese billionaire. Yep. They don't know much about him, but he's the board head of the board of like 40 companies and based out of Hong Kong, but he's a Chinese entrepreneur.
Right. And this is to get American refined petroleum products from Canada through the, and I guess North American, Canadian tar sands oil refined in Texas. We extract the poisons from it, leave them for the Texans and the Louisianans, and then ship that stuff through that new canal that's going to compete with the Panama Canal through Nicaragua over to China. You nailed it. You just connected the dots, Mark. Thanks for the call. Brilliant. Audrey in Richton Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey.
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. I'm calling because I was listening to your conversation at the beginning of the show where when he was losing the debate, he began calling you names like some sort of child. And of course, what he was doing was following the same, exercising the same game plan as all those who prioritize or appear to prioritize money over people.
Mm-hmm.
He vilifies the people who are seeking justice. He vilifies the people who are seeking equality, the people who are targeted by injustice and equality. Vilifies them so as to justify the evil that, you know, he's promoting.
Yeah.
This is how, you know, when I've examined the history of slavery in this country, I'm African American, and you look at how the slavery in this country was ruining this nation's economy. Abraham Lincoln figured this out a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they cheapened the human worth of one group of people in order to cheapen the cost of human labor of everybody who needs to work.
Yeah, black, that was the effect of it.
Red,
yeah.
And so now what they're doing is cheapening the whole collective of humanity in order to gain what they want from this country. Me personally, Tom, I believe that, you know, people who put money, capitalism, you know, laissez-faire capitalism over humanity and human worth and human necessity and civilization. These people, when they roll out a map of the world, it appears that they don't perceive nations. They perceive land masses chock full of resources that they want to add to their own selfish wealth.
Yeah, and let's not forget that cheap labor, Audrey. I wrapped up one of the books I wrote, What Would Jefferson Do, actually, with the comment that we did not end slavery in the United States. We merely exported it.
Yep.
You know, half of the clothes we wear are made by slaves.
Exactly. And that's part of what's happening now. You know, when they talk about globalizing the market, I mean, personally, I don't believe they've globalized the market. What they've done is they've globalized profiteering.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
What they did is they made the markets open so that they could open the market on darn near slave labor, you know, wage slavery, or even straight up slavery. You know, some of these products, they now come, you see the certified fair trade markings on like tea and chocolate and coffee and stuff like that. That's to identify that they've at least given fair pricing to the farmers so they can hire workers, actually hire them instead of trick them into slavery to harvest these products. For man, you know, to put into the products that we buy, and you know, all they do, people with that mentality, is prove true. Was it Abraham Lincoln who said, "No man is free while any man is a slave"? I don't know, but the fact is that expression keeps being borne out in what's going on. I think part of the problem why our children aren't getting the history lessons is because these people want history to repeat. They want the stuff that worked for the East India Trading Company or almost worked for it,
yeah,
and their subsidiaries. They want that stuff at work again here and now.
I agree. And in fact, I think that this is one of the reasons why we don't teach in our public schools. I mean, you know, you got this Koch brother curriculum now that is being promoted to the public schools that diminishes the role of even, you know, Abraham Lincoln and actually inserts Rush Limbaugh into the textbooks and Newt Gingrich into the textbooks. And I think that the reason that they don't want people to learn about the Four Freedoms, they don't want people to learn about the Second Bill of Rights, they don't want people to learn about how close America got to actually being a truly egalitarian society, is because they're trying to take us back to the way America was from 1920 to 1929, before the New Deal, when the rich were getting fabulously richer and the poor were getting horribly poorer. They called it the Roaring Twenties, but it wasn't roaring for working people. Working people were actually seeing their incomes go down. The only thing that was roaring about it was the stock market and wealth at the very top. Audrey, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Very, very well said. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, we got a minute. It's yours.
Okay. Need to talk about the precautionary principle relative to the incredible power of destruction. When you look at things like, you know, it can take tens of thousands or millions of years to create something that can be destroyed in a few minutes. So when you look at something like, you know, a forest, an idiot can burn down with a match that could take 1,000 years to build. But considering this Keystone Pipeline, consider the oldest country in the world is less than 1,500 years old, most only 100.
Right.
Well, those problems are going to last for thousands of years. So, like, the Keystone Pipeline is not just a water pipeline where the water it flows. Well, it has 1,440 PSI in it. It takes an enormous amount to heat this toxic, caustic sludge up and make it flow. So we're wasting energy. If it springs a leak, 1,440 PSI, consider a bicycle tire is, you know, 100 PSI for a racing bike.
Right, and a car is typically 30 PSI.
Yeah, so that's going to spray out fluid a long way. So
yeah,
that's going to be a lot worse than a railroad car bursting.
Yeah.
And also, again, it takes an incredible energy. But that's going to make our water table poison for thousands of years.
Yeah.
Again, most countries in the world are only 100 years old.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, when you start looking at things in those timescales, not just Keystone XL, but also nuclear power. Spot on, Jeff. It's always great to hear from you. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How do you think America would be different if just one piece of FDR's vision, like the government as the employer of last resort, happened? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see here. Janice in Englewood, Colorado, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Janice, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am well, thank you. I hope the same is true of you.
Yes, I am.
Great.
Listen, when you were interviewing the Native American in North Dakota, they're, Ed Schultz has interviewed them, and they are willing to die over this Keystone XL pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Schultz has also been to Nebraska, where he interviewed Bold Nebraska and the farmers and ranchers, where they're going to put this pipeline through their land.
Right.
Not only will their land diminish in value, but if there is an accident, they are financially responsible for it, not TransCanada.
Wow. Wow. This is terrible. It's amazing. Janice, thank you for the heads up on that. I appreciate the call. Ed does great work. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark, watching Free Speech TV in Las Vegas, Nevada? Okay, let's try Michelle, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'd like to follow up on the freedom from fear and bring it into the present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know anything about the science of what fear does to the brain, and it can be measured with
yeah.
MRIs, and it
puts the whole body into a state of almost shock, basically.
Exactly, and it has long-term effects, and sometimes they're permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And we can show this with MRIs. We can show the evidence. We have a new Surgeon General, finally. I'm wondering if there's a new way to go about, you know, a high-tech way of attacking fear from poverty, crime, racism, all of these things, if we can show these pictures, show, we have empirical evidence. You can show the pictures.
Right.
And show people this is what this environment is doing to people, not only in this country, but all over the world. It's horrifying to think of the long-term consequences if we don't get a hold of this fear environment and turn things around.
Well, it even goes a step beyond that, Michelle, or maybe a step back before that. If you go back and look at, for example, the Willie Horton ad, if you go back even and look at the LBJ Goldwater Daisy ad, if you look at, how often Ebola was mentioned, over 900 times, 900 major stories in the networks before the election, only 40 since the election, and yet the Ebola crisis in Western Africa continues to rage on. Fear is being used on a regular basis by the Republican Party, by and large, as a political tool. It's that powerful.
Right, and I understand that. I think the part that's missed out, and even the Republicans, I think, may not understand this. It's a tool. It's a rhetorical tool. They leave it in that category. What I'm saying is, at the science level, this causes changes to people's minds, brains, bodies.
Right.
That is significant beyond just politics.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Michelle, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org to find out what's going on in the world. Bob Ney is on the line with us, the author of Sideswiped. Congressman, welcome back to the program. Bob? No Bob. Did Bob vanish? Bob, is your phone? Is your phone on mute?
No. Hello?
Oh, now I hear you.
There we go.
Hey, you knew John Boehner. You worked with John Boehner. You were a Republican in the House of Representatives. You knew him quite well. You write about him at some length in your book, Sideswiped. John Boehner was, I'm assuming, just reelected. I saw the chyron on CNN about 20 minutes ago that they were voting on House leadership. A, can you confirm whether or not he was just reelected? And B, how does he keep his caucus in line? How does he hold his power?
Well, on this, let's look at today's case for a second here. We knew he'd get reelected because you count the numbers. What we know is there were 15 against him. Gohmert and Yoho were running, but there were 15 people against him. We knew that.
Right.
There were two members, which was Representative Heiss of Georgia and John Ratliff of Texas, and they said prior to the election they would vote against him. So that took it to 17. And then you had Steve Pierce from New Mexico. He had voted before, and he was undecided. And then you had two people that voted against him. So when you start to look at all the numbers, there were at least 12 last time, and this time there were about 17. I don't know the final count yet because I haven't been able to go online. But here's the point to all of this. And people say, well, Louis Gohmert is crazy. It's irrelevant. The point of this is political blasphemy today. It really is. I don't, one vote or two votes or something of that nature is different than, 12, 13, 14, 15 going up the ladder. Now, also, some of the Democratic members were gone to the funeral in New York, Mario Cuomo, and then that meant Boehner had a little bit of a more comfortable cushion. 39 votes would have had a second round, 29 votes if everybody was in attendance.
Hmm.
And if that happened, he would not be Speaker, and because there wouldn't be a second round. They would come out with somebody else. And the other thing is that, he spent a lot of money, Tom. He pulled a lot of strings. He had a wider margin this time. Had this not been the wider margin, he wouldn't be sitting there today.
Yeah.
I think, though, to see a sitting Speaker
have this amount of reaction against him by the conservative arm of his party does not bode well for the opening day. This isn't going to go away. Also, the Senate side, you know, they make the Keystone Pipeline the number one crusade. Well, guess what? The great big alarm button of fear isn't as big now because gas prices have ironically dropped as they're, you know, presenting this as their right out of the barrel effort in the Senate.
Right.
Then you have the House going towards changing the 40-hour work week, you know, going in the Obamacare 30-hour to 40-hour. And then the conservative think tank people, Tom, are calling saying, are you crazy? What would you want to do that for? So you have a complete lack of any direction on the opening day.
Yeah.
This has to be an advantage for the president. You have Mitch McConnell, the Republican senator who's leading, you know, the Senate, came out yesterday and said, we're not going to make ourselves scary Republicans. So when you put all of this together, if the president's advisors and the president are smart politically, they will seriously be in a driver's seat, and the Republicans are just in disarray from day one. I don't care if Gohmert wins or loses or what this final vote count was. It is serious political blasphemy to have these many votes against a sitting speaker.
Fascinating. Yeah, it looks like he just won. They just showed a whole bunch of guys on the floor of the House shaking hands and slapping backs on CNN. So I'm guessing that Boehner just won.
Oh, he won, but
yeah.
But again, very damaged.
A pyrrhic
what
victory.
Do from here,
as they say. So what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, we're carrying a report today on Senator Feinstein wanting to ban torture. And, you know, I think everybody that follows politics knows that Senator Feinstein was considered, as a Democratic member, quite, you know, a hawk on certain issues in a sense of supportive of the CIA. And, of course, the report has come out on the torture, and on the it's dovetailed into the fact that her own staff had the computers hacked, although the CIA denied it. So I think what senators found out is that, you know, the CIA is lying when their lips move. And if you look at the Bush history of torture, and then you look at this report that came out, she's now it's brought her to the point where Senator Feinstein is getting very, very aggressive on sending a bill to the forefront. I don't know how much support she'll get from it, but she's also sending a letter to the president to dovetail on the bill, and she wants to push for some really interesting techniques in the sense of she wants procedures videotaped.
Right.
She wants that to happen.
These are the kind of things that the libertarians, maybe there's only one in the Senate, Rand Paul, I'm not sure, maybe Mike Lee, but that the libertarians might agree with her on, are they not?
Well, that's true. And even John McCain, if he, you know, follows through with what he has publicly said, that, you know, that torture is not the way we need to be,
right,
then she should have the support of quite a few people and should bring along some votes. But she's going to file the legislation that would ban the long-term detention of CIA detainees. It would also limit the list of interrogation techniques used by intel officers and then provide a swift Red Cross access to detainees, you know, for their rights. The famous documentary, it won an Oscar, Taxi to the Dark Side by Alex Gibney, years back verified that, you know, our enemy, the Taliban, were saying, hey, this is a bad guy. And they took a taxi driver, and he was beaten to death in our prison in Bagram, Afghanistan. So we've known these things, you know, way back from when the Bush administration began the entire torture techniques with the, you know, blessings of Alberto Gonzalez, who the White House attorney, later attorney general, and the president himself. And, of course, they denied all of these things.
Right.
And now we know that that they were true. How much this goes back to get those who were guilty of this, of course it won't, but at least it would stop it for the future.
Fascinating stuff. Congressman Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, reporter with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to you.
You too.
Okay, we'll talk again. And we'll be back right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
So Louis Gohmert got three votes. I wanted Louis Gohmert to be the Speaker of the House. I really did. But, you know, he's not going to go away. He's, what can you say? It's amazing. Back to the Four Freedoms. I think it's so important that we periodically return to founding principles. And one of the founding principles of this country, at the time it was, you know, basically only applied to white males, but it was still a founding principle, and we have expanded that franchise over the years, thank God. One of the founding principles is we're all in this together. And that the reason why we have democratic institutions, the reason why we have government, is to provide for the health and happiness of the people, for the general welfare of the people. In fact, the Declaration of Independence even goes so far as to say when a government fails to provide for the health and welfare of the people, it is their duty, their obligation to overthrow that government and create a new. So we were, you know, our founding documents are so clear that the purpose of government is to do something good for everybody in the country, to be there for us, to represent us, and for and as a way for us to help ourselves, essentially. I'm looking for my pocket constitution, but I've got so much paper all. Ah, here we go. And I don't need to read you the Declaration of Independence. I think, okay, here it is. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security, which is what we did in 1776. The laws of nature and nature's God entitle them to a decent respect of the opinions of mankind. I mean, it's just, it's very, very straightforward. And 74 years ago today, Franklin Roosevelt came out and said, and this, I think, was the really extraordinary part of his State of the Union address of the 77th Congress. The basic... In fact, let me back it up a little bit. He says, men do not live by bread alone. They do not fight by armaments alone. Those who man our defenses and those behind them who build our defenses must have the stamina and the courage which come from unshakable belief in the manner of life which they are defending. Now, we're fighting World War II. And he's saying, we're not just fighting Hitler. We're not just fighting against the bad guys. We are fighting for something. What does our nation stand for? Go back to first principles. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Happiness? The United States of America, the Declaration of Independence was literally the first time any document, any country had ever been birthed in the history of the world with the word happiness as part of its founding document. FDR continued. He said, the mighty action that we are calling for cannot be based on a disregard of all the things worth fighting for. The nation takes great satisfaction and much strength from the things which have been done to make its people conscious of their individual stake in the preservation of democratic life in America, and it's small d democratic. Those things have toughened the fiber of our people, have renewed their faith, and strengthened their devotion to the institutions we make ready to protect. Certainly, this is no time for any of us. Now, keep in mind, we're in the middle of a war with Hitler and with Tojo. Certainly, this is no time for any of us to stop thinking about the social and economic problems which are the root cause of the social revolution, which is today a supreme factor in the world. He's talking there about communism. For there's nothing mysterious about the foundations of a healthy and strong democracy. Not just communism. Communism, fascism, everything. He said, the basic things expected by our people. This is what I want to hear in President Obama's next State of the Union address. The basic things expected by our people of their political and economic systems are simple. Really? President Franklin Roosevelt, what are those things? The basic things expected by the American people of their political and economic system. What are they? He says, equality of opportunity for youth and others. And others, at that time, I'm assuming, was, you know, encompassed people of color, women, people who were largely disenfranchised in 1940. Equality of opportunity, jobs for those who can work. Now, I asked this question in the last hour, you know, how, in your mind, how would America be different if the government of the United States was the employer of last resort? If there is more than enough work to put to in the United States that needs to be done, we're $3 trillion behind in our infrastructure. And that would just take us up to where we should have been if we hadn't stopped spending money when Ronald Reagan became president. If we hadn't stopped the continuous rebuilding of America. But instead, we've got, you know, infrastructure that dates back to before the Reagan era. We've got water systems, septic systems, power systems, schools, government. All, you know, it's basically we've been frozen in amber for 44 years. 34 years, excuse me, since the Reagan Revolution. But how different would our country be if FDR's suggestion that anybody who wants a job should have one? And if capitalism can't provide for that job, if industry can't provide for that job, then it is the obligation of government to provide for that job. Now, what are the things that happen when unemployment goes down to zero? Number one, wages start going up. Competition for jobs gets tighter. Number two, people, you know, if anybody can work, people start walking away from dead-end jobs, or they don't like them jobs, looking for better. You know, these are healthy things. These are good things in a society. Okay, so he said jobs for those who can work. What are the basic things expected by our people and their political and economic systems? Security for those who need it. Security. The ending, this was a standalone paragraph in President Roosevelt's 1940 State of the Union address, the ending of special privilege for the few. Really? I shared with you yesterday the story of this this multimillionaire who's flipped out because he thinks that his brother's going to get a free pass on having killed people. We have two criminal justice systems in the United States. There was an article yesterday in the Financial Times about how J.P. Morgan Chase is going to pay $100 million as a fine for, you know, something that they did. And you see Jamie Dimon being, you know, perp walked? No. We've got two criminal justice systems in this country. One that largely does nothing that other than protect the rich and powerful. And the other that puts more people in prison than any other country in the world among the working class and the poor. That it arguably, you know, had its origins back in the slave patrol days. And then finally, Franklin Roosevelt says, what people expect of their government is the preservation of civil liberties for all. Ending special privilege for the few, civil liberties for all. Is it time yet?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is it too late to reimagine an America that works for everyone? Or have we been too Tea Party-fied by the billionaires? Welcome back. Jim in Portland, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, I was thinking about being a breed Indian and the Keystone Pipeline.
Okay. You are Native American?
Oh, part.
Okay.
Like a lot of us are.
Yeah.
The problem is they want to cut a swath right through all those beautiful lands. And believe me, I haven't gone out and argued or got arrested or gassed or beaten in a long time. I fought against the Vietnam War. But now I think it's me and a whole lot of old-timers. I'm 64 and disabled. But I swear to God, I will stand out there in my wheelchair and argue with them.
Mm-hmm. To stop the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yes, sir.
Why?
Do you know what it'll do to the tribal lands? Do you know what it'll do to the farmlands?
Yep.
Yeah. There isn't a chance in hell I'm going to put up with that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, Jim. Very, very well said, and thank you for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, and thanks for calling in and sharing with you. I'm totally with you. Thank you. Ray in Merrick, New York. Hey, Ray, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Well, I was going to call about a couple of other things, but the Mario Cuomo passing, would you believe it?
It's Murphy's Law, Ray. So you want to call back later?
No, that's all right.
Okay, go for it.
I cannot believe this.
Isn't it interesting that Mario Cuomo's funeral is happening and it's not being live streamed, but the funeral of the police officers was?
Right. But there's another thing about the things that he was acknowledged to be great for. And it's never been mentioned this whole week. And that was simply the fact that he wrote a letter to the Pope. When John Paul was very adamant about how Catholicism should be interpreted by leaders of nations around the world, and especially targeted against America, Mario wrote a letter, a very brief letter, to the Pope describing how Catholic leaders and politicians and leaders of country have a different duty and standard. He described it in probably three or four paragraphs, if I recall. It is, I call it the Mario Bull to the Pope. And it, it's an acknowledged gem in which he didn't attack the Pope, but he had to explain to him how Catholic politicians have to govern differently than what the church mandates are.
In other words, I'm responsible to my constituents first and to the church second in the context of my public life.
Well, it's a little bit broader than that. I'm surprised that you're not aware of it, because
I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah, I got to hang up.
All right. Good talking to you, Ray. Thanks a lot for the call. And you timed it perfectly, Ray. We're hitting that break at 20 after. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. So John Boehner was just elected Speaker of the House, or re-elected Speaker of the House. The question I should have asked Bob Ney is, how many drinks has John Boehner had at this point in the day? Just wondering. Is he crying yet? Yeah. I wonder if there's an association between the two. Probably is. It would make a certain amount of sense. Anyhow, Roger in Lake Ariel, Pennsylvania. Hey, Roger, what's on your mind today?
Hello. I wanted to go over 2 points. I've noticed when you debate this about anybody, when they are about to, some of them lose control or about to lose the argument, they go into what I would call a nervous laugh. And W.E. Du Bois, in a debate with Booker T. Washington, coined that behavior or characteristic as amused contempt. The person cannot come up with a rational idea, so they what's called the part of the human condition. We can't lose an argument, as opposed to me just saying, Tom, I think you got a point. Let me think this over with, and we'll stop this conversation right now, and I'll come back at you. To walk away with your dignity as opposed to coming up with ridicule or being derisive.
Yeah.
Now, my dad, when he was alive, he once told me, based on my character at the time, he said, well, obviously you can't fight everyone, but when you're communicating with people, try not to be derisive, try not to ridicule, try not to insult. When the other person starts to do that, then you know you've won the argument. But most importantly, they have lost because they have lost control of themselves. And therefore, you know, it's time for you to back off and let them die with dignity or some kind of way.
I agree. I danced up to the, you know, when I told Austin, I can't believe you said something that stupid. I was on the edge of crossing my own line right there. You know, it's it never should become personal. And unless you're talking about personal stuff. I mean, if you're talking about your relationship with somebody, that's a whole different thing. But if you're talking about Keystone XL Pipeline, it shouldn't be about who's smarter or who's dumber or who's got a, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's a debate.
Yeah.
And you both have different sides to the argument. And but I've noticed that many of the people that you debate, they tend to do that. So I just thought I'd bring it up. And
sure.
One more thing, too. I believe the person's name was Austin. I don't believe he was speaking to you. He was talking with you, but he was my belief he was actually speaking to your audience. It's not for him to win the argument with you, but to win over your audience to him.
Or to plant the memes out there that are part of his job description. I don't disagree. Roger, thank you for the call. Lawrence in Berkeley. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Happy New Year. I came upon a piece of news yesterday, which is so astonishing. It can't work. It can't wait till Friday. Anything goes Friday. If I were going to say that there's one region in the world which is actively participating in anarcho-syndicalism, democratic anarcho-syndicalism, or what they call libertarian municipalism, free self-governing communities based on direct democracy, where would you think that is?
I mean, there any country that's in the process of being deconstructed or reconstructed, you've got Libya, you've got Syria, arguably Afghanistan and Iraq, but our presence there is so great that I doubt something like that could happen. Kurdistan, maybe? Where?
Yes. You got it. Nobody knows this. It's in Syrian Kurdistan, which has formed a region which they call Rojava, Rojava. And they have, it's about 3 or 4 million people in the north of Syria. You know, they were terribly oppressed by, you know, previously. And it's based on community neighborhood councils. That's the anarcho part. It's based on workers' cooperatives. That's the syndicalist part. And since they're in the middle of a war against ISIS, they have free choice militias that you can join any militia that you want, including women's militias, and go to fight. And this is the reason why Kobani, which is the battle in Kobani is going on for the last 4 or 5 months, and there's very desultory bombing, but the Obama administration does not want the Kobani Kurds to win, because if they won, they would be able to go north and take the rest of the border with Turkey and have the Turkish PKK, which believe more or less the way they do, and the war against ISIS would be very quickly over if the Obama administration would allow these revolutionary Kurds to fight ISIS and help them.
Yeah.
He won't.
Yeah.
And what's astonishing about it is that the leader of the Turkish Kurds, a man by the name of Abdullah Öcalan, he has been in jail for 15 years since 1999. And he has been reading, among other people, Murray Bookchin. Now, you know who Murray Bookchin is, right?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Murray Bookchin is a New York Jewish anarchist theorist and social ecologist. And he talks about libertarian municipalism, which is based on, as I said, free self-governing communities.
Right. Which is relatively unrelated to the libertarian movement in the United States, which is all about corporatism.
It's social libertarianism. It's communal.
Right.
So you have.
Well, if it's communal, it's more communism, isn't it?
That's right. It's the original idea of communism.
Yeah, the kibbutz style communism.
What council communism? It's called.
Right. I said kibbutz style communism. I mean, these are classic communist societies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what's happening in the autonomous region of the Syrian Kurds.
What you're describing is the spontaneous eruption of small d democracy. And there is a reason for that. I'm going to rant about that right after the break. Thanks for sharing that information with us, and thanks for the call. It's always great to hear from you, Lawrence. Back with the Red Deer after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Now, those of you who are longtime listeners are going, I know where he's going. Those of you who have not listened in a couple of years are going, what? Red Deer? Democracy? Really? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. Okay, democracy. Harvey in Berkeley was called and was pointing out that basically there are eruptions of democracy happening across Kurdistan, or what was once and probably one day again will be Kurdistan, and in Syria, these autonomous, self-governing communities with workers' cooperatives and things like this. And this is probably one of the most important points I have ever made, I think, in my writing, things that I've learned in my life, in the research that I've done. And that is that up until 1776, it was argued by most philosophers and most political scientists that democracy was the abnormal state of humankind, what would have been called the state of man back then. That democracy was abnormal, that democracy required people of great wisdom and insight and consideration, and they had to do it very carefully, and they had to organize things just the exact right way, and the Constitution had to be written perfectly, and it took virtually divinely inspired people. And because democracy was just tough, it wasn't a natural thing, that the natural state of humankind, according to political and largely political philosophers, historical philosophers. The natural state of mankind was what Thomas Hobbes had described in 1634 in Leviathan, which was that there would be, in the natural state of humankind, there would be no means to transport, there would be no arts, there would be no letters, there would be no entertainment, there would be no, and life would be nasty, short, and brutish, right? Or nasty, brutish, and short, or whatever the quote was. I'm paraphrasing. So when I was writing, this was back in, I think, 2000 or thereabouts. I was writing a book that ultimately became my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, which is still in print. And Jacob Needleman wrote The American Soul. He's one of America's great historians. He says, a riveting and absolutely essential book for reflecting upon an awakening to the real meaning of America and the hope it still offers to the world. This is what I think is the hope that's in this book. I was reading Nature, which is one of the top two scientific journals in the world, top three, arguably. And there was this piece in Nature by Tim Ropert and L. Conrad from the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Sussex in England. asking the question, what is the natural state of animals? Or rather, how does democracy play out in the animal kingdom? Because the assumption was always that dominance-based political and economic systems are the natural way. The kings and popes, this is the natural way. So what they did was they started observing, they had a bunch of red deer near the university, and they started observing them. How do they make decisions? You got a herd of deer, a couple hundred acres of forest, a couple of water holes. So throughout the day, they're, you know, the deer are all out there chewing their cuds or whatever, deer, you know, nibbling on leaves and things. And at some point, they've got to make the decision to go to the watering hole and get a drink. How do they make that decision? Well, you know, if you look at the way that we normally think of these things, you would assume that, you know, the wise elder, the head deer, the alpha deer, right, would make the decision. Would say, okay, guys, it's time to go drink. Time to go have our water. In fact, what they discovered was that as the animals were just standing around grazing, as it came close to the time when typically they would go drink, they would start pointing, some of them would just start randomly pointing their bodies toward one of the three watering holes. And when more than 50% of them were pointing their bodies toward one of the three water holes, the entire herd would just head that direction. And very often the alpha deer was in the background, is in the back, go, hey, what happened? Where'd everybody go? Now, this is a really complex decision-making process, because if they go too soon, you're going to have some animals that are going to be, you know, still hungry. If they go too late, you're going to have some animals that may be dehydrated, young, elderly. This is a really critical decision. But it always hit that 51% until they brought a predator. Now, what about supermajorities? You know, when they wrote our Constitution, the founders, Madison and buddies, put into there that there are certain things that require a supermajority. And, you know, 66 votes, as it were. Jan, come on in. Have a seat. You can just walk in front of the camera. It's no big deal. And so the founders are saying, okay, there are some things that are so important we need a supermajority. So these guys, Roper and Conrad, at the University of Sussex, they're watching these red deer, and they're noticing that they make their decision based on when 51% of the deer are pointing toward a particular water hole. That's when the entire herd moves. So they thought, what happens if we throw a predator into the mix? And so they staked out a predator, or the I don't remember the details of it. You can read it in the book. Like, you know, put a wolf or something or a fox near one of the water holes. And what happens when they do that is that suddenly, instead of 51% of the deer pointing toward a particular water hole before the entire herd moves in that direction, it took 2/3 of them. So not only is democracy intrinsic to the nature, to the natural world, not only is it normal, it's not the abnormal state of mankind or humankind. It's the normal state of all species. But I guess I just said it. And then there's that subtle variation, that supermajority necessary for really critical decisions, like which watering hole are we going to go to when there's a predator in the area. So then people say, well, why even have an alpha male? Well, it turns out the alpha male principally gets first choice of sexual partners. That's it. The alpha male is not a leader. Decisions are made democratically. So I called up Conrad and Roper when I was writing this book and interviewed actually Conrad. I interviewed Tim Roper. And he said it was really interesting. He says they wrote, you know, modified democratic decision-making mechanisms are comparable to the tradition of many human societies of using a 2/3 majority rather than a 50% majority for decisions that are potentially more costly if taken than if not taken. So anyhow, I called him up and he says, quite a lot of people have said, my gorillas do that or my animals do that. And in fact, what he was telling me was that, you know, I said, you know, has anybody called you up and said other animals other than red deer do this? He was like, yeah. He says, one of the first calls I got was from an ichthyologist, right, a fish guy. They're studying schools of fish. Have you ever watched schools of fish? How is it that they all turn at the same time? Well, they're not all turning at the same time. Every single one of them, as they swim, they move, you know, right fin, left fin, right fin, left fin. So they're swinging back and forth, left, right, left, right. And they might swing right 3 degrees left 1 degree, right 3 degrees left 1 degree. That's a 2 degree vote for turning right. When more than 51% of the fish, you slow-mo this thing, same thing with flocks of birds, same thing with the ball of gnats in the air, insects. You ever seen a ball of gnats, you know, in the sunlight? There's just a, there's a few weird ones flying around the edges, but most of them are all in this ball. When 51% of them move to the right, the whole crowd moves to the right. So anyhow, democracy is our natural state. And that's the story I wanted to tell you. As I said, it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? I think I've mentioned it in a couple of other books, but there's a couple of two chapters about it in there, including my interviews with Conrad and Roper. And apropos of what Harvey said, you know, of hey, democracy is breaking out in Kurdistan in northern Syria. This is an interesting thing. Jan Fry?
Frill.
F-R-E-L.
F-R-E-L.
Ah, okay. I always thought it was an I at the end. Jan Frull is
Jan
for this. Yeah, Jan is my editor, I guess, over at Alternet. I'm constantly submitting stuff to you. And Jan, it's great to have you in the studio.
Great to have you. And I have to say...
You got to eat the mic. You got to
Hear about
it.
Great to have you. And I have to say, after being in the progressive media for a while, I have a lot of admiration for what you do. And
I'm
really happy to be in the studio.
Thanks. What is your take on the state of progressive media right now? You're in the midst of this milieu.
Well, so, you know, it's funny, Tom. I started a thing back in 2002 called TomPaine.com, which was based here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I've been watching the evolution of progressive media. I've been watching its pitfalls and its developments. And obviously, the biggest thing that happened to us since then is the predominance of the Internet and what it has done... sort of good and bad. I mean, I think we're in a world that is, in many ways, so much better to communicate the message.
As long as we have net neutrality.
Right.
I have a theory that I want to run by you. We have just a minute to the break, but just real quickly. Outsiders and insiders. I don't think it's left and right. I think it's outsiders and insiders.
Uh-huh.
And people are, you know, people are scratching. Mm-hmm. Why isn't MSNBC catching fire? Why is Fox?
Right.
And I believe it's because Fox plays the role of outsiders. Right-wing radio, the role of outsiders. You got Laura, what's her name, next door, broadcasting the Heritage Foundation.
Ingram.
Ingram. Taking on John Boehner.
Right.
Right? Whereas nobody on MSNBC would ever take on Nancy Pelosi.
No.
And by and large, well, there isn't that much of a progressive talk radio infrastructure, but... You know, it's that statement that Summers made to Elizabeth Warren. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the language we have inherited to kind of understand the political world we're in is one of the bigger problems. For example, like you pointed out, left and right. There's a good corollary there, which is that in ancient Japan, the emperor had a minister of the left and a minister of the right. They didn't really have politics. They were just different kinds of advisors.
Really?
And yeah, the notions of... left and right really will send you in spiral.
That's interesting.
Insider.
It's almost a variation on the old court jester. You know, the court jester was actually a very important advisor. He was the only person who could tell the truth to the king without having his head chopped.
Right, exactly. And actually, that's going down right now, right, is because that's the only place where truth gets said is on The Daily Show.
The Daily Show, exactly.
You can say that to powerful people because it's all a joke.
Bingo. We'll be right back. Jan Frell is with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll pick up some of your calls, and Jan and I are going to have a conversation here, so stick around. It's going to be interesting. And then, welcome back. And then we will rejoin our commercial stations in 4 minutes when they finish their breaks.
Got it.
So, we're talking with Jan. So, you were saying.
Oh, so anyway, so I was saying is, you know, I think also one of the reasons why you don't get... a big audience for MSNBC, where you do with, say, Fox, is the notion that that MSNBC would speak to what's popular. They don't. I don't really see it as a matter of left and right. I see it sort of a matter of there are these huge issues that resonate, popular issues that resonate with 80% of the public that don't get discussed on any of the cable TV channels. It doesn't matter if it's MSNBC. There's no real meaningful political content for the population.
Right. And in large part, much of that is because to discuss, for example, the TPP or to discuss free trade, even the larger frame, the largest frame.
Yeah.
Was in 1996, did Bill Clinton make a horrible mistake? You know,
right.
to even have that conversation is something that will not happen because it contradicts the business interests of the owners of the media.
Yeah, I just think, and it's, you know, you can put a lot of layers of complexity to it, but I think just calling it basically, we live in a business state. The media largely represents business interests.
Yeah.
And I'm a Chomsky media model guy. I think basically you have, there's the power voice, which will be the New York Times. The so-called right-wing media really is just basically reflects the extreme desires of the business state. And the only place where you and I are permitted to be critics is when we criticize the excesses of what the more demanding business media wants.
Yeah.
You cannot criticize the power and what the power does. You're allowed to criticize a portion of what the extreme elements of the business state wants. And then we can be
And if you do, you become marginalized.
Right. Yeah. You can have a role. You can be cited as saying this is an excessive demand.
Right.
And that's basically the game you can play. And there's some number of people in the media and maybe some of our friends who make careers out of that.
Yeah.
But they're never really actually channeling, discussing, kind of going through the larger issues that the population deserves to talk about. And you obviously.
How do we fix that?
Well, I mean, after looking at this one for a while, I think fixing that is inspiring people to make media, explaining to people that what's called the right, which I, as I said, I think is just the business state,
right.
Spends a third to half of its money on media, whereas on the left or whatever, what I would just call popular media, that gets 1% of the philanthropy. For whatever reason, the philanthropy in this zone goes to issues. 99% of the funding goes to issues and not to media.
Right, which is crazy. I've had this conversation with people in the Democratic Party, some very serious politicians, and they just don't get it. It makes me crazy. I mean, there's maybe five or six people in this city, who in this town, who really get it and really work for trying to get genuine progressive media out there. But the conservatives all get it. They know that without Fox News, they wouldn't have won an election since Reagan, basically.
Right.
I mean,
no, that's true. And then, you know, and then the challenge is there's the language we inherit that we have to use. Like, for example, I write headlines. I say conservatives. I say right wing. I genuinely, if you push me hard, I would say, no, they're just defenders of the power, you know, business state. They're defenders of the power elite, rapacious defenders of it.
Yeah.
Servants of the master. But they're not actually right wing. They're not. There's nothing right about, you know, there's nothing right-handed about them.
I call them the Reich wing.
There you go. For humor, it's fun for humor's sake.
Yeah, but that's about it. We'll be right back. Jan Frel is with us. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm in the studio with us is Jan Frel from Alternet. James in Tacoma, Washington, wants to plug an event that's happening there, and I wanted to get him in. James, you wanted to plug something that's going on at a dispensary in Tacoma? Got a lot of listeners in KBCS there.
Hey, that's a marijuana dispensary.
Yes, I do, Tom. Hey, thank you for you and yours.
Thank you.
But we are having a fight out here in Tacoma and in Washington State. We the people voted in marijuana legal in the state of Washington, and they have fought us and fought us and continuing to fight.
Really? I was out there a couple of weeks ago and went into a dispensary and bought some pot and smoked it, and it was great stuff.
Okay. Yeah, well, you can, Tom, right at this moment. Tonight at 5 o'clock at the municipal building in Tacoma down on St. Helens and 9th,
right.
They're having a debate as to shutting down all the dispensaries in the city of Tacoma.
Oh, really?
And they have emptied them and emptied them all along. And we've got Big Pharma and the Koch brothers, all these guys hitting this area big.
So this is the equivalent of a dry state. This is the equivalent of banning alcohol, like in North Carolina all those years, that kind of thing.
You know, they're trying to. Jay Inslee's against pot, and I don't know why, because the people that surround him, I know people that I know Jay, and I know the different
Jay's a good guy
around him that use it.
Yeah. Pardon? Yeah, amazing. Okay, so James, real quickly, where, when tonight?
Tonight at 5 o'clock at the municipal building downtown Tacoma.
Okay.
It's on 9th and St. Helens.
You got it. Thank you very much. There you go. Be there or be square. Thanks, James. Jan, what do you see as the most urgent issue facing our nation that we should be what's the conversation that America needs to be having? I mean, we're sitting here, we're on commercial radio stations.
I guess different times of the day I'll tell you different stuff. Some parts of the day I'll say it's the banking issue. I'll say banking is basically understanding.
Well, it all starts with money, right?
Yeah, understanding the role of banking in democracy is right there, right in the beginning. But other times of the day, I mean, I think the fact is most people don't have even the slightest political identity. They have no political meaning in their life. There's nothing political. They're just either consumers or less. They might have a social media identity and construe their politics through social media and think they're doing politics, but that's not. And I think that's one that's really interesting because I find sort of in the audience, tracked in the stories we read, where things get attention is this sense that there's very little meaning in everyday American life. They see a lot of advertising around them where meaning gets destroyed or resold to them. And it's at the heart of something spiritual, but I think...
I was going to say, this is an existential concern.
Honestly, I think that if I had to just really pick one, it's that we don't have political public life.
Right.
And there's very little sense of political experience. When it does come to it, you know, when we do talk about somebody's political life, they construe it in terms of voting every 2 or 4 years.
Right.
For like 5 seconds, and it's this endless debate about, you know, which candidate they might elect. But that's not self-government.
Yeah.
And the opportunity for self-government is there. It's a huge psychic undertaking for somebody to try to get there. It's not easy. But socially, it's not there. And so I basically what I see is a huge missed opportunity to be fulfilled in that way. I think the word republic means real people. And the way you get made real is by being part of the public dialogue, the public debate, and you find meaning by being part of the public.
Today is the 74th anniversary of FDR's Four Freedoms speech, which was a State of the Union address. And in it, he actually talked about how we can't just be fighting the Nazis and the Japanese. We have to be fighting on behalf of something.
Yes.
What gives us meaning?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, a free nation has the right to expect full cooperation from all groups. The best way of... As men do not live by bread alone, they do not fight by armaments alone. Those who man our defenses and those behind them who build our defenses must have the stamina and courage which come from unshakable belief in the manner of life which they are defending. The mighty action that we are calling for cannot be based on a disregard of all the things worth fighting for.
Yeah.
And, you know, he goes on and he says, the basic things expected by our people of their political and economic systems are simple: equality of opportunity, jobs for those who can work, security for those who need it, the ending of special privilege for the few, the preservation of civil liberties for all. How far have we wandered from this?
Well, I mean, we've wandered really far, and I'd say, you know, I'm still with him on three of those. One of those, no fault against FDR. I think one thing that's changing is this question about allocating wealth through jobs.
Right.
I think you just have to look at what's happening with technology and how and wealth concentration and say, maybe we need to drop some of the New Deal baggage on that about everybody gets a job in order basically to have some economic security.
Yeah, he's thinking the best welfare program is a job.
Right.
Maybe now it's time for a guaranteed minimum income.
Guaranteed minimum income, and there's a lot of interesting ways to do it. I think if you look at, for example, what made Sarah Palin so popular in Alaska when John McCain picked her, it was that she marginally increased the oil allocation for any resident.
Well, her family, the year that she was running for vice president, took over $40,000.
Amazing. And there's a lot of ways to do that. We, just like Chomsky says, we massively fund our science and medicine.
Right.
It could very well be that any program that gets, you know, federal funding for that kind of research basically gets a dividend for any patents built on it, and we just get some percentage of the returns on these products that are making other people a fortune. That's how I would sort of reallocate the wealth from Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
There are a number of other ways of doing it. I just think I don't really wish work on people. I just wish them well. And that's one of these things that's going down
right
now.
It's going to be really interesting I think it's next year Switzerland is having the vote, or is it later this year?
And
it's going to be fascinating. We're out of time, but we got to wrap it up. Jan Frel, You can read his stuff over at alternate.org, right? Okay, thank you so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow, and don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.